From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Haddon. He's the author of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, a murder mystery told from the point of view of an autistic boy. The book is on many bestseller and summer reading lists. Batman Begins is now in theaters. We'll hear from original Batman creator Bob Kane. Also, jazz guitarists revisit their roots. Kevin Whitehead reviews CDs from Gary Lucas and Eugene Chadbourne. And Lloyd Schwartz tells us about a set of private demo recordings just released from songwriter Stephen Sondheim. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. British writer Mark Haddon is the author of the novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 48 weeks and is a favorite on summer reading lists. The novel is told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy named Christopher, who's a high-functioning autistic. Critic Michiko Kakutani writes, "Mr. Haddon writes with such sympathy, such understanding of Christopher's interior life, that he makes all his obsessions and needs into a mirror of our own cravings for safety and order." This is Mark Haddon's first novel. He's written and illustrated several children's books. When his novel begins, Christopher finds his neighbor's dog lying dead, speared by a pitchfork, and Christopher wants to find out who did it. The greater mysteries he's faced with have to do with comprehending his parents and the confusing and threatening world around him. Here's a reading from early in the story.
"I pulled the fork out of the dog and lifted him into my arms and hugged him. He was leaking blood from the fork holes. I like dogs. You always know what a dog is thinking. It has four moods: happy, sad, cross, and concentrating. Also, dogs are faithful and they do not tell lies because they cannot talk. I had been hugging the dog for 4 minutes when I heard screaming. I looked up and saw Mrs. Shears running towards me from the patio. She was wearing pajamas and a house coat. Her toenails were painted bright pink and she had no shoes on. She was shouting, 'What in God's name have you done to my dog?' I do not like people shouting at me. It makes me scared that they are going to hit me or touch me, and I do not know what is going to happen. 'Let go of the dog,' she shouted. 'Let go of the damn dog, for Christ's sake.' I put the dog down on the lawn and moved back 2 meters. She bent down. I thought she was going to pick the dog up herself, but she didn't. Perhaps she noticed how much blood there was and didn't want to get dirty. Instead, she started screaming again. I put my hands over my ears and closed my eyes and rolled forward till I was hunched up with my forehead pressed onto the grass. The grass was wet and cold. It was nice."
Mark, what is your main character's behavioral or cognitive problem?
If he were diagnosed, he would be diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. I suppose you call it high-function autism, in that he can function on, you know, a day-to-day basis in a kind of rudimentary way. But he has a serious difficulty with life in that he really doesn't empathize with other human beings. He can't read their faces. He can't put himself in their shoes. And he can't understand anything more than the literal meaning of whatever's said to him. Although I'm very careful in the book not to actually use the word Asperger's or autism.
Why not?
Because I don't want him to be labelled, and because I, as with most people who have a disability, I don't think it's necessarily the most important thing about him. He's obsessed with mathematics. That's one of the little hobbies he has. It's one of the ways he manages to pattern and organise his daily life and keep chaos at bay. And as a good friend of mine said after reading the book, a friend who is himself a mathematician, it's not a novel about a boy who has Asperger's syndrome. It's a novel about a young mathematician who has some strange behavioural problems, and I think that's right.
Because he sees the world in a very literal way and hears conversation in a very literal way, he doesn't understand jokes, he doesn't get irony, he doesn't understand human emotions, he has no real empathy for other people. What are the things that really scare him because they're so incomprehensible?
Because he can't put himself in other people's shoes, he doesn't really understand what other people are going to do. And other people are therefore extremely unpredictable. He likes his life to be safe and ordered. He's never gone farther than the end of his own road without someone to keep him company. So his life is very small and circumscribed. And it's things that threaten to wreck that pattern. It's change and difference and chaos which really terrify him.
He hates being touched. He can become violent when
indeed,
he's touched.
He does indeed, yeah.
Is that pretty typical of somebody with autism or with Asperger's syndrome?
I think it's fairly common, although a lot of people said to me, he seemed like a very real character. Did you do a lot of research? And I have to say, honestly, that I did more research about the London Underground and the inside of Swindon Railway Station, where some of the novel takes place, than I did about Asperger's syndrome. I gave him kind of 9 or 10 rules that he would live his life by. And then I didn't read any more about Asperger's, because I think There is no typical person who has Asperger's syndrome, and there is large and diverse a group of people as any other group in society. And the important thing is that I did a lot of imagining, that I did a lot of putting myself into his shoes and trying to make him come alive as a human being, rather than getting him right, whatever that might mean.
Now, that's an interesting exercise for you, because what you're doing is putting yourself through the exercise of having empathy for a boy because of his problems, can't empathize with other people.
That's true, and I realized very shortly after I started writing the book that the whole thing was littered with, you know, paradoxes. On the surface, it's a very, very simple book, partly because his voice is a very, very, very simple voice. And yet you're right, it needs a lot of empathy to write a character who has no empathy. Another paradox is that he says he can't tell lies. He needs to tell the truth all the time, and he always tries to do this. And yet, somehow, he always gets things wrong. We read the novel over his shoulder, saying, "You've got this wrong, you've got that wrong." And we can see more than him. He's a very unreliable narrator. And perhaps for me, the biggest paradox of all is that you'd think someone like Christopher, who can't empathize, who can't understand anything more than literal meaning, who can't see the bigger picture, would be a really bad narrator for a novel. And yet, it's a wonderful, wonderful voice to write a novel in, because it helps you avoid the pitfalls that so many novels fall into. He never explains anything. He never tries to make up the reader's mind one way or the other about anything, because he has no real idea of there being a reader out there.
Now, your main character, who is autistic, doesn't read novels. Although he's the narrator in your novel, he has a great deal of difficulty comprehending fiction. And there's a short excerpt I'd like you to read about that.
"Mostly I read books about science and maths. I do not like proper novels. In proper novels, people say things like, 'I am veined with iron, with silver, and with streaks of common mud. I cannot contract into the firm fist which those clench who do not depend on stimulus.' I found this in a book in the library in town when Mother took me into town once. What does this mean? I do not know."
Where does this quote come from? Is this something that you made up to sound as obtuse as he finds metaphors as being?
Funnily enough, it's actually a quote from Virginia Woolf. It was Virginia Woolf on an off day in the middle, I think, of The Waves, an author whom I love, actually, but who sometimes got a little too carried away.
Wow, that's really terrible. That's totally incomprehensible and terrible. But that's your idea of how all fiction reads to him.
Yes, certainly.
One of the things you had to imagine is what it would be like for Christopher to, for the first time, get on a subway by himself and go to London, where he's never been, to find his mother. So he's coming from like a suburb of London to London. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Odyssey for him. So maybe you could just describe how you imagine, for instance, the subway, you know, the train looking from his point of view.
As we all know, when we visit a strange city, particularly in a foreign country, you're bombarded with information and noise and sights and sounds in these places. And for someone like Christopher, who sees everything around him and attempts to understand it all, it's completely overwhelming. Although I have to say that, strange as Christopher is, this experience isn't so alien. I think one of the reasons when we read about it that we understand it is because it's an extreme version of something we've all experienced at some time or other in our lives.
What did you most empathize with about Christopher and his confusion?
Of all the parts of Christopher that I empathize with, I have to say it's not the confusion that I empathize with most, it's the mathematics. I don't know whether we've said yet, but the book is peppered with little maths questions and maths puzzles and diagrams, because he is very good at maths and obsessed with maths, and he uses it as a way of blocking out the world sometimes, in the way that many of us use crosswords or other kinds of puzzles. And that's pretty much like myself. I very nearly did mathematics at university. And even now, after I've had a month or two of novel writing, I get a yearning for numbers again and go back to working on maths for a week or so. So all the maths in the book came straight out of my head. And that is the part of Christopher that is unadulteratedly me.
That's funny, because I thought you were going to say that you often felt so confused by the world and by people's emotions and their response to you in the same way, or in a different way than he does. But that's not it, huh?
No, I really love interacting with other people. And in that sense, I'm very, very different from Christopher. But this is one of the ironies about Christopher. If we talk about Christopher as a whole, everyone talks about Asperger's syndrome and autism and talks about him as a kid with a disability. And yet every single little oddity of his behaviour I have taken from someone that I know who doesn't have that label, who is not called a disabled person, who's not labelled with Asperger's or autism. You know, he has a little habit for determining whether a day is going to be an unlucky day or a lucky day. You know, I know someone who does that. He has a habit of disliking foods that are yellow or brown. I know someone else who's like that. And someone else who can't eat foods if different food types are actually touching on their plate. And all of these people are, you know, quote, normal, unquote, people. But it's only when we put these things together that I find that I've got a portrait of a person that we call disabled.
Do you know somebody who can't comprehend jokes? Because they take everything literally, yeah.
I know a few of those people, and I certainly know a few people. And I, to be honest, most of these people tend to be either scientific or academic people, people who can't really do conversation with others, people who find it very hard to listen to what the other person is saying to them because they're so worried about what they're going to say next that they're concentrating on that.
Mark Haddon speaking with Terry Gross. His novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, is out in paperback. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mark Haddon is the author of the novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy who has a type of high-functioning autism.
Now, I've read that you worked with people who had autism. Is that right?
That's true. After university, I spent a few years working with both children and adults with a variety of physical and mental handicaps. Even at the time, autism was a fairly kind of loose and conjectural diagnosis. And it's only now looking back that I realized that some of those people were autistic. Although I have to say, all of them were much more severely disabled than Christopher is.
What was your job?
I had a variety of jobs. My first job when I left university was to work as a live-in volunteer with a young man who was crippled with multiple sclerosis. And he needed constant attention. We two of us lived in his house and did 24 hours on, 24 hours off looking after him. And from then I moved down to London and did a series of part-time jobs helping with kids and adults, both in training centres and at home in their families.
What got you into that work?
What got me into that work was spending 3 years at Oxford University and feeling that I'd kind of eaten too much birthday cake and I needed some kind of compensation to set myself right again. I'd had 3 years of you know, hard work, but in a fairly luxurious setting in which you know, if you're a student at a prestigious university, you're kind of the center of attention and you think you're pretty important. It was really nice to go out there and do what I thought of at the time as a proper job in which I was helping other people for a change. And I really felt it restored some kind of inner balance to my life.
I'm thinking that you might have learned a lot of things about yourself by working with people with disabilities, because since some of those disabilities were cognitive, you might have had to change things about yourself in order to communicate to them in a non-threatening way.
Funnily enough, I think I've learned more about myself by being a writer. I mean, the nice thing about working with people with disabilities is that you don't think about yourself. You know, you have to be patient. You have to think about someone else all the time.
No, but that requires thinking about yourself, particularly if you're not patient. You know, that would be like an immediate diagnosis there. I am not patient, therefore I have to learn how to be patient.
Well, I can be quite a patient person, so I quite enjoy doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the time when I've really started to learn about myself is the hours on end you have to spend as a writer just thinking quietly in a room on your own. And I think actually for many people that would be a harder thing than working with people with disabilities, being in your own company that much.
You know, the story is written from Christopher's point of view, but reading it you can't help wonder about how difficult it must be for Christopher's parents, because there's such a burden on them to make the world manageable for him and to give so much of their time to creating a manageable world for him. And the parents aren't getting along. They're having problems themselves. Some of those problems are because of differences in opinion about how to deal with Christopher. So even though Christopher has no empathy, as a reader, you have to start thinking about what it must be like to be one of his parents.
That's true. And although I said earlier there will be no right depiction of someone with Asperger's, because people with Asperger's are a huge and varied group, having met a lot of parents of kids with disabilities, I think there is a kind of general picture of what happens in many, many families who have a child like Christopher. And as I said to someone recently, it's probably very similar to having a child who's special in other ways as well, a child who's peculiarly gifted. Again, I've seen parents, seen families where one parent, and it's usually the mother, devotes their life to looking after this child, and that child becomes their life project, and the other parent feels pushed to one side, and as if they have no role. And I've seen many, many families break up for precisely that reason. It causes other problems as well, in that as the child grows older and wants to become adult, you find that the parent who's given their life to looking after them has a vested interest in them staying as a child. And that causes huge difficulties.
Mark, do you have a dog?
No, I don't. I have one cat, and that's all.
No, because I was thinking that the idea of a dead animal might be particularly upsetting to you.
It does, and in fact, I am a vegetarian, and on the whole, I'm very kind to animals. But I have a rather sort of dark English sense of humour. And when I wrote that first page with the dog impaled on the fork, I found it quite funny. But I found it quite funny only if I described in this flat, emotionless, toneless voice, which I really liked, and which over the next few pages became Christopher's voice.
What did you like about that flat, toneless voice?
What I like about it is perhaps best explained by saying, if you hear a really good comedian is funny because they don't laugh at their own jokes. And the converse is true as well. If someone's telling a very sad story, it's somehow sadder and more moving if they're not moved by it. That stops it becoming sentimental. And that's what I really liked about Christopher's voice. It's both funny because he doesn't seem to understand why it's funny, and it's more moving because he doesn't really understand why things are sad that are happening around him. And that stops the whole thing becoming sentimental.
Why don't you read that opening paragraph that Christopher narrates about the dog?
It was 7 minutes after midnight. The dog was lying on the grass in the middle of the lawn in front of Mrs. Shear's house. Its eyes were closed. It looked as if it was running on its side, the way dogs run when they think they are chasing a cat in a dream. But the dog was not running or asleep. The dog was dead. There was a garden fork sticking out of the dog. The points of the fork must have gone all the way through the dog and into the ground, because the fork had not fallen over. I decided that the dog was probably killed with the fork, because I could not see any other wounds in the dog, and I do not think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it had died for some other reason, like cancer, for example, or a road accident, but I could not be certain about this.
Yeah, a part of his mind seems to be like your forensics mind, and the other part seems to be just kind of loopy and not really very intuitive at all. I guess that leads me to think, like, how do you size up a mysterious and shocking situation when you see it? Where do you look for clues, and what do you make of it? And he's both approaching it in a very logical forensics kind of way. He's also thinking strange thoughts like, I don't think you would stick a garden fork into a dog after it died for some other reason, like cancer or a road accident. I mean, that's true. That's kind of inarguable, but it's a kind of strange thing to be thinking.
It's a very strange thing to be thinking, and I think that's why I found the voice so funny. Although I have to say that there seems to be another aspect of Christopher's voice, because he doesn't try to push the reader one way or the other, trying to make them feel this or that about what he's said or what he's seen. Some people have read the book and wept their whole way through it and found the whole thing sad and the ending sad. And other people I've talked to have found it very funny the whole way through. So that people have completely different reactions to the same book.
Mark Haddon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Haddon is the author of the novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's out in paperback and has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 48 weeks. It's also a favorite on many summer reading lists. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's last wish, by Justin Cronin, author of Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Hills Have Jazz. That's the title of a new recording from Eugene Chadbourne. Kevin Whitehead has a review. Also a conversation with the original Batman creator, Bob Kane. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Stephen Sondheim's private demos. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Two guitarists revisit their roots on two new records. On one, Gary Lucas plays the music of his old boss, avant rock guru Captain Beefheart. On the other, Eugene Chadbourne digs into vintage jazz tunes. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews each.
Bye. When Big Joan sets up, played by New York's Captain Beefheart revival band, Fast and Bulbous. Few composers anywhere combine intricate textures and offbeat dance rhythms as deftly as Beefheart, who left music long ago to devote full-time to his other career as the semi-abstract painter Don Van Vliet. No one does Beefheart quite like Beefheart, but his pieces are so roughly elegant, it's good someone's playing them, especially with his old guitarist Gary Lucas on hand to ensure the tricky lines and counterlines and cross rhythms spring to life. Gary Lucas's co-leader in Fast and Bulbous is saxophonist Philip Johnston, who arranged the parts for four horns, including baritone saxophonist Dave Sewelson from his old Microscopic Septet, the group that recorded Fresh Air's theme. With a horn section often playing Beefheart's vocal lines in blurry unison, there are moments that suggest the Van Vliet University marching band. But some soloists stamp the material, like free jazz and Latin trombonist Joe Feidler on When It Blows, It Stacks. More important, the rhythm section makes the tricky bits swing. The band Fast and Bulbous played the first of its occasional gigs almost 3 years before they recorded the CD, Porkchop Blue Around the Rind for Cuneiform. The players still sound like they're growing into the concept. Fitting into eccentric material, custom tailored to its creator, isn't easy, but a CD leads to more gigs and more growth, so count on their Beefheart treatments to get even better. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, the amazingly good North Carolina guitarist Eugene Chadbourne, who likes to demolish rock and country music, revisited some jazz tunes that helped inspire him. The composers include Tad Dameron, Eric Dolphy, and Sun Ra. Chadbourne's diverse collaborators include a guitarist he just played with for the first time, drummer Richie West, formerly of the band Camper Van Beethoven, and jazz harmonica maverick Bill Barrett. Oliver Lake's composition, Heavy Spirits, from Eugene Chadbourne's CD, The Hills Have Jazz, on Boxholder. The Lake and Roscoe Mitchell pieces here date from the 1970s, when the avant-garde knew how to be intense and quiet, an aesthetic seldom espoused by guitarists who like to crank it up. Chadbourne and company take a refreshingly low-key approach, finding their own way into this stuff and creating their own musical space, as on a slow-motion version of Miles Mode by John Coltrane. That's Chadbourne on banjo. Eugene Chadbourne has made a gazillion differently recorded or produced CDs, LPs, and cassettes through the years. But The Hills Have Jazz, despite the pointedly ugly cover art, is one of his more refined efforts. For a guy who once led a band called Shockabilly, it's almost delicate. Almost.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Coming up, the origins of Batman. This is Fresh Air.
Batman! Robin!
That's right. We're after some jewel thieves, but our car's been disabled. May we use yours?
Sure, hop in.
No, I meant we'll take yours and you stay here with ours. There might be trouble.
Well, trouble don't bother me none. But if that's the way you feel about it, take her and welcome.
Pretty wooden for superheroes, huh? Apparently one of Batman's special gifts is the ability to survive even the clunkiest portrayal, like that 1949 movie serial. Now, Batman is back in theaters.
A vigilante is just a man lost in the scramble for his own gratification. He can be destroyed or locked up. But if you make yourself more than just a man, if you devote yourself to an ideal, and if they can't stop you, then you become something else entirely.
Which is?
A legend, Mr. Wayne.
Liam Neeson and Christian Bale in Batman Begins. Neeson plays mentor to Bale's Batman. Batman was created 66 years ago by Bob Kane. Over the years, he's watched the Caped Crusaders' continuing adventures with alternate pride and horror. Kane created Batman in 1939 and continued drawing him for DC Comics until 1966, the year the Batman TV series debuted. When he gave up drawing Batman comics, Kane started painting Batman on canvas. Kane died in 1998. In 1990, he told Terry Gross that the idea of creating a new superhero was initiated by Kane's editor at DC Comics.
Well, I was having lunch with the editor that time, Vincent Sullivan, and he said he was looking for another superhero. Actually, Superman was created in 1938, and the period when I spoke to Vincent Sullivan was 1939. It was about a year later. And prior to that, I was doing fill-in cartoons for DC Comics and making maybe $20, $25 a week. And I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, Siegel and Shuster. He said they were making $800 a week apiece. Now, in 1938, that was comparable to about $5,000 a week today. And I was kind of a poor kid from the Bronx looking to, you know, get wealthy and famous. So I said, hey, for that kind of money, I could create a superhero. So I went home that weekend, and I drew upon some of my early influences. And as I recalled, I was 18 at the time, but when I was 13 years old, I saw a book by Leonardo da Vinci, a book of inventions. And he had one book with a flying machine, an ornithopter, and it was a man on a sled with huge bat wings. And even Leonardo had a quote on that particular invention. It was the first man in flight, the first glider, actually. And the quote was, your bird shall have no other model but that of a bat. And it kind of initiated an idea to me about a Batman. And that was when I was 13 years old. So that weekend, I drew upon that influence and... There were movies I used to be influenced by as a kid, one called The Mark of Zorro, The Dual Identity with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And that gave me my second influence. During the day, he was a board count in the Southern California in the 1880s. And at night, he became a crusader fighting against the injustices of the dictatorship at that time.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers. I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. And I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, you said that his look, Batman's look, was inspired in part by the Zorro movie that you liked so much. Now, you were, when you were young, in a gang called the Crusading Zorros, and you used to wear hooded masks. What was the connection between the Crusading Zorros that you were a member of as a kid in the Bronx and the Batman look?
Well, to begin with, we wore Zorro wore a mask at night to hide his identity, so that the desperados that he would apprehend would know him during the day if they saw him. Therefore, they couldn't retaliate. And when I was a kid and living in the Bronx, we had these clubs, that we would all band together to protect ourselves against rival gangs in other neighborhoods. It was pretty tough in the Bronx at that time. And so we wore Zorro masks to hide our identities when we would raid one of the rivals' clubs and kind of beat up on them. And therefore, if they wanted to retaliate, Terry, they wouldn't know who to apprehend because we wore the masks of Zorro. It was a dual identity, so to speak.
You tell a terrific story in your book, Batman and Me, about how when you were young and in this gang, the Crusading Zorros, that you know, you weren't wearing your costume this day, and you were being pursued by a rival gang called the Vultures.
Yeah.
And at one point, before they really beat the heck out of you, at one point you thought that you had overcome them. What was the feeling like then? And I'm wondering if you felt like a superhero for that brief moment when you thought you had outwitted them.
Yeah, well, you see, I was heading toward my neighborhood, and we had a lumber yard that we used to play out in with a lot of nooks and crannies, and I knew it very well. And somehow that early evening, none of my gang members were around to join me in the fight, and so I jumped over the fence and kind of hid in some of the nooks and crannies until they caught up with me. But then I remembered Zorro's daring do deeds of jumping around when he fought the desperados in the Spanish West. And so I started to climb shafts of lumber. And when I arrived on the highest part of the lumber yard, the highest shafts, I felt like I was King Kong atop the Empire State Building. And I started thrusting these shafts of lumber down on the vultures who were below in the lumber yard. And then I started swinging around on the pulleys and I really felt for a moment victorious because I had the advantage for quite a while because I knew the lumber yard and they didn't. But then I fell off one of the shafts of lumber, cascaded down around me when I landed on it, and I fell to the ground. And that's when they all attacked me. There were about six of them. And they really beat up on me pretty badly. They broke my arm and a couple of my front teeth. And then they crushed my knuckles, my right hand, the drawing hand. And actually, this injury inadvertently kept me out of the service in World War II, although I enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor. But I have a kind of partial use of my drawing hand, and I have two porcelain jackets that remind me of that ominous day in the lumberyard when I was a young and reckless boy growing up in the Bronx.
Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not-Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and in my daydreams. I felt, instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night. because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper in the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Well, actually, it's called the Union Suit character. And for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work. And mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the batarang, and so forth. I used the entire bat mystique to create my bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more misterioso. Yeah. Somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
Bob Kane, the creator of Batman, recorded in 1990. He died in 1998. Coming up, Sondheim sings Sondheim. This is Fresh Air. Sondheim Sings Volume 1 is a collection of demo recordings from Stephen Sondheim's private archives. They span the years 1962 to 1972 and include Sondheim singing such songs as Losing My Mind, Send in the Clowns, and Broadway Baby. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
With a few exceptions, most songwriters aren't particularly good singers. But we want to hear composers singing their own songs because they convey subtleties of meaning and feeling we don't always hear from better vocalists. About his own singing, Stephen Sondheim said, "For those of you who have not had the pleasure of hearing my voice before, I tend to sing very loud, usually off pitch, and always write in keys that are just out of my range."
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I love you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. About you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, I dim the lights and think. sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind?
It's especially revealing to hear early versions of passages that Sondheim later changed. For example, in Losing My Mind, he sings, "I love you so, it's like I'm losing my mind." But by the time Follies opened, Sondheim had changed "I love you so" to "I want you so." It's a subtle change. This character is being driven crazy less by frustrated affection than by frustrated desire. The final version is more powerful because it's less romantic, less sentimental. There are also unusual songs that never made it into the shows for which they were intended. Here's the almost melancholy Invocation, which was replaced by the more suitably upbeat, playful Comedy Tonight as the opening number of the farcical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Gods of the theater, smile on us. You who sit up there stern in judgment, smile on us. You who look down on actors, and who doesn't, bless our little company and smile on us. Think not about deep concerns. Think not about dark dilemmas. We offer you rights and revels. Smile on us for a while. Gods of the theater, smile on us.
Many of the songs on this collection are dark, even bitter in tone. So it's a treat to hear the relish, the breathless energy and speed with which Sondheim tears into the hilarious Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, also from Forum.
Everybody ought to have a maid. Everybody ought to have a working girl. Everybody ought to have a lurking girl to put around the house. Everybody ought to have a maid. Everybody ought to have a menial, consistently congenial, and quieter than a mouse. Oh, oh, wouldn't she be delicious, tidying up the dishes, neat as a pin. Oh, oh, wouldn't she be delightful, sweeping out, sleeping in. Everybody ought to have a maid. Someone who, when fetching you your slipper, will be winsome as a whippoorwill and graceful as a grouse. Fluttering up the stairway, shuttering up the windows, cluttering up the bedroom, buttering up the master, puttering all around the house.
There was a TV documentary in which Sondheim was coaching young British singers. His advice was extremely precise and pointed about character, musical phrasing, attention to verbal nuance and implication. His demonstrations really made the young performers better, smarter, more efficient. At one point, he introduced what he called a medley of my greatest hits, Send in the Clowns. He wanted the young singers to underplay, which is just what he himself does.
Isn't it rich?
Sondheim, of course, is famous for his wit, his intelligence, his musical subtlety. But many of us who love his scores love them for their cutting honesty and depth of feeling. I'm reminded a little of T.S. Eliot and his most famously intimidating poem, The Wasteland. People are daunted by its complex frames of reference. Yet when you listen to Eliot's recording of The Wasteland, it's not the literary labyrinths, but the poet's underlying sadness and droll humor that hit you. Stephen Sondheim has been the most serious poet of the American musical, and among the funniest. It's great to hear him illuminate this lost material in his own voice.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts Boston and is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Sondheim Sings, Volume 1, on the PS Classics label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. When I'll be in a show. Broadway, baby. Making rounds all afternoon. Eating at a greasy spoon to save on my dough. Oh, at my tiny flat, there's just my cat. A bed and a chair. Still, I'll stick it till I'm on a bill. All over Times Square, someday maybe. If I stick it long enough, I can get to strut my stuff. Working for a nice man like a Ziegfeld or a Wiseman in a big time Broadway show.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the legendary jazz pianist Hank Jones. He turns 87 next month, and he's still performing. He influenced a whole generation of piano players and has jammed with some of the greatest names in music. Join us for the next Fresh Air.